netcasting from Chicago, Los Angeles, and Sydney. You're listening to this week's FX Podcast from FXGuide.com.
This podcast is brought to you by the new term at FXPhD.com. Hand in hand with FX Guide, our training site, FXPhD, allows you to do online training with the benefit of industry professionals to guide you. This new April term includes training in Nuke 7, Hero, editing, grading, lens tech, and even maths for VFX. Check it all out at FXPhD.com.
Thanks for joining us for this FX Podcast. The FX Podcast is where we talk one-on-one with top visual effects artists doing cutting-edge work. We dig deep into the technical side, advance the craft of visual effects, and pay respect to the hardworking people creating amazing work. Be sure to check out all our podcasts at fxguide.com/podcasts. Well, I'm joined today by Mike Seymour.
I can't believe you get that whole intro out in one go. I always assumed that you had to edit it, because you and I don't normally get to sit in the same room to discuss the FX Podcast. Very impressive, my friend.
Why, thank you. Yeah, well, I'm oftentimes editing individual words, but not today. I'm feeling good.
I've been looking forward to this film, Oblivion.
Yeah, me too. It's every time I've seen any kind of release of any trailer or any piece that I've seen, I've been very intrigued by it.
I liked Mission Impossible 3, and so 3 or 4, whatever the last one that was that Tom did. I actually quite liked Jack Reacher, so I like Tom Cruise as an actor. So he's a good action actor. But, of course, we're here to talk about the visual effects, which was actually done by Digital Domain.
Right. We're going to speak with you're going to speak with Eric Barba and the DP, Claudio Miranda, which I'm really happy to hear about.
Yeah, we've been doing this a bit more lately, talking to the DPs as well, and I thought it'd be really interesting to explore that relationship between the DP and the visual effects supervisor in the context of, obviously, a big-budget effects film. So.
Right. And I wanted to mention, you know, there's been some talk after the Oscars. There was a little bit of rumbling about Claudio not thanking the visual effects artists for the stage. And, you know, I personally just was really, I've known too many people that have worked with Claudio Miranda and also have seen footage from him and pulled keys from footage that he's shot and know him to be a very big friend of visual effects and very collaborative worker. And I just don't think it's our fight. I don't think it's his fight. I don't think of any...
Well, no, but you'll hear that he and Eric are actually really, really good friends. They've done a lot of films together, and there's a very good working relationship there. And actually, I think that's... that's a really significant aspect of it, right? Like, I mean...
Absolutely.
And, you know, he's not... how can I put this? I don't know Claudio really well. I mean, I've interviewed him and I spoke to him at some length. But, I mean, he was joking about the fact that, as you'll hear in the interview, you know, he didn't win his Guild Award for this season. He did win the Oscar. But I don't... I think, you know, you've got to understand Claudio's background a bit as well. Like, Eric is a visual effects guy. We understand that really well. Claudio's actually come up through the ranks from being sort of grip gaffer and stuff. So he's really used to complex setups on set, really complicated rigs, really interesting ways of doing things with very interesting filmmakers. So when you then sort of swing that into Life of Pi and then onto other things that he's done, it kind of makes sense. He's comfortable working with a very technical setup.
Absolutely, absolutely. And that's all I was trying to get to, is just that I've heard nothing but amazing things from actually working with him on set. And right. I think that if the Oscar night hadn't gone the way that it did with the multiple slams back to back, it would never have been a blip. And in fact, of anybody, he was probably the most vocal that night in the backstage interviews about the contribution of visual effects.
Yeah. Since I've done this interview with him, I've quoted something from this interview several times, which you'll hear, which is his comment, basically I'm paraphrasing, which is that, you know, because I brought this whole thing up that you're talking about. And he said, as you'll hear, his perspective is just to not be sort of coming at this from the point of view of just being the lowest cost bidder. In other words, his point of view for the visual effects industry is it'd be good to move to a point where jobs are being awarded on merit, not on the basis of just dollar value, which obviously implicit in that comment is the idea that the work is equivalent from anyone and therefore you just take the lowest cost thing. So from my point of view, and maybe someone else is going to object to this, but my point of view, petrol is like that, right? Or gas, mm-hmm. You call it, right? Gas is very homogeneous to me, right? If one petrol station has it cheaper than another, I believe my car will notice no difference. I do not consider visual effects a commodity like that. I consider that the craft of Eric is very different and distinct, and his team at DD, from the craft you'd get from a less experienced, less professional outfit somewhere else.
Absolutely. But, and in fact, one of the things this film, ironically, in this conversation, I'm intrigued by is the Skyroom, I think it's called.
Right, the large psych they had with the projectors.
Yeah, I just think it's such a great solution, and they're going to talk a bit about that, but I'm sure in the interview. But I think that, you know, not doing that green screen, such a
look. I won't spoil it, but Eric has a very funny remark about that, which I think is particularly pertinent.
Well, I'm really glad to be doing with this here in person. We're obviously recording this while Mike's in the U.S., having just finished up the live 6-hour broadcast from the Foundry booth. This is a week or so after that, maybe. But
actually, if I can jump in there, you mentioned the Foundry. Obviously, we did a lot of stuff with Nuke at the Foundry back when we were at in Vegas. But we have a killer Nuke training course happening over at FX PhD, which is a from the trenches guerrilla Nuke course, basically giving people the stuff that they need in every day. Like basically, if you're a super kind of Nuke operator, this is the stuff that you would tell somebody else as to like kind of power. Tips and stuff. And I was just mentioning it because we had a great time with the Foundry there in Vegas. And of course, Nuke is just such a powerhouse for visual effects across almost every film in the industry.
I'm looking forward to that. I remember years ago we used to do some jam sessions with Flame, for example, get a bunch of artists together. So it kind of we used to pick up some good tips. It's always good. That kind of class should be very interesting.
Yeah, there's one thing to know how to operate something, and it's another thing to know if you kind of if you know how to operate something already a bit. How to actually just do the kind of power user stuff that really takes it to the next level.
I'm also really excited to see the Hero and Commercials course.
At the Hero stuff, yeah.
I've been using Hero quite a bit and really, really loving it and really amazed at how the Foundry has progressed that product. It just fits into my workflow very well. So I'm excited about that. There's a whole bunch of stuff. The Pimp Your Lenses class that you're doing, I've been getting a little taste of that here and there as you've been putting the classes together, and that looks really fun if you're into
yeah and optics. Also from an obtuse point of view, we're doing a maths course which is heavily influenced by, we've done a maths course before, by stuff we learned from talking to supervisors, because before on this trip I was up at ILM and I was talking to one of the supervisors there who actually came from a physics background. Anyway, we just got this is all sort of, you know, feeding into this maths course we're doing, because we're kind of doing maths that you would need for visual effects. And it is pure math. I mean,
well, the
it's
first
maths.
Course, you did one of these earlier, and it was great. I loved it.
Yeah, that really, I mean, there's some of that is repeated in this course because there's huge overlap, of course, as you get into 3D LUTs and the maths behind it and stuff to do. That course was pretty much focused on the render equation, and this stuff is focused similarly on that kind of maths that you use in visual effects, but touching a bit more of maths that you might use on set. But anyway,
let's jump into the show. But before we did, you know, just in case somebody is listening that doesn't know about PhD, why don't you just do the elevator pitch real quick?
It's really simple. Artists showing you and teaching you work on an online environment that runs for the course period. So it starts and runs on a weekly basis. It's not just something where you download and you don't know whether it's up to date or whether it's relevant or not, because for many of the courses, the person that's teaching, what we call the professor, is available online to answer questions in the forums. In addition to that, you get access to the software. So in the case of Nuke, you could use Nuke. It runs on a VPN license so that you could produce things for your showreel. You can't use it in production, but it's a fully unwatermarked version of the software. And then in addition to all of that, of course, you get to work with really great people, because almost everybody in PhD is a practicing professional trying to take their career to the next level.
So pimp your career.
There you go. Actually, be careful with that word. Somebody thought that we were implying prostitution, but I was actually picking up on an American phenomenon of like pimping your ride, making it kind of a souped up version. So I certainly had, exactly. I certainly don't, as I certainly as a parent of two daughters,
there'll be
have
no prostitutes involved.
Yeah, prostitution is abhorrent to me, but yeah, in the more colloquial, friendly kind of sense of making stuff cool, that's what we're referring to.
Cool. Well, let's jump into this. I'm excited to hear this. This is Mike Seymour interviewing Eric Barba and Claudia Miranda.
Jack? An object came down in 1-7.
Got it. On my way.
60 years ago, Earth was attacked. We won the war, but they destroyed half the planet. Everyone's been evacuated. Nothing human remains. Our job is security and drone maintenance. We're the mop-up crew.
2 more weeks, Jack, and we can leave and join the others.
Doesn't seem right. We won the war. Now we have to leave.
The Oblivion Project originated as an 8-page treatment written by the director Joseph Kaczynski and pitched as a graphic novel in 2007. In 2010, Kaczynski directed Tron Legacy, which he shot with DOP Claudio Miranda, who would go on to win the Oscar for Life of Pi. That film was actually shot on in stereo on the Sony F35. For Oblivion, which is really a film that's a cross between Moon, Wall-E, and Minority Report, Tom Cruise plays a robot repairman who's having a really bad day. Now, while Tom's character Jack Harper goes down on the surface a heck of a lot, a key part of the story takes place on this platform high in the sky, one with huge windows, loads of glass, and tons of shiny reflective surfaces. Well, the Oblivion director this time teamed up again with Claudio Miranda as the DOP, but in mono, shooting on the F-65. The lead house was Digital Domain, and between the director, Miranda, and the VFX supervisor, Eric Barber, the team came up with a really epic but highly cost-effective solution for filming that sort of sky control lab set. I start, though, by talking to Claudio Miranda about his choice to film with the F-65, the newest of the Sony 4K cameras.
It just had a really kind of great look. I mean, we were also interested in the resolution for the camera because originally the movie was intended to potentially be 4K release as well. And there was something about capturing Iceland in that kind of, you know, resolution that I thought would be really beneficial for Iceland. So we liked that idea. And, I worked with this director with the Sony, you know, F-35, and Joe kind of liked that sensibility of what that camera could do for this movie, you know. And I feel like every camera kind of has their movie, you know, and I felt like the F-65, you know, was perfect for this one. You know, I have no regrets using it.
What did you rate the camera at?
You know, like anywhere between 800 and 640, you know.
And there are some, even in the trailer, there's some like really low-light scenes, especially when Morgan Freeman's being lit by his cigar and stuff. How did you find it going into those low lights, and especially when you're looking at it in rushes?
I mean, it's, you know, that was great. It's just nice to be able to have a camera to be able to retain all that, you know, and for me that was very critical. And you know, some people might think it's post, but they're on that shot, but you'll see Tom and the reflections of his glasses, and that's real, you know. I think I called Tom the most expensive bounce card I've ever used, you know. That's a joke. He laughed. As I was, you know, pushing him closer to Morgan Freeman to kind of, you know, have this kind of, you know, this interaction of light off of Tom and just giving him that fractional light reflected back onto Morgan.
Actually, it's funny you should bring that up because, and this might seem like an obscure question, but I really did notice that, and that made me start looking at many of the shots and many of the close-ups of the actors, and I noticed that you seem to be getting, in some cases, very realistic, obviously, eye reflection, but in some cases, you seem to be having a really nice, very sort of precise ping in the eyes, somewhat normally sort of like seemed a bit lower than high in the eye. It was more like about halfway up the eye. I was wondering how you lit the eyes and how sort of conscious are you of those highlights in the eyes, because they seem to really work, especially on an actor like Tom Cruise.
Oh, yeah, there's one scene where he's, you know, being, you know, tied, and we were, you know, and that's the kind of interesting thing about, you know, shooting and with these digital cameras, is that you really can, there's probably an eighth inch of depth of field on some of those shots. And you could really ride that, the focus pull can really ride that eighth of inch of depth of field on the eye, and it really becomes a really personal, fantastic shot, you know. And it's, there's some things you just kind of can't do, in the old means, in a way, you know.
Do you like to enhance those eye pings in post? Were you getting those in camera?
No, it was pretty much in camera. For that shot, I mean, I had light, you know, three kind of harsh lights kind of aimed right at Tom, you know, and then, you know, maybe I did diffuse that one down a little bit, but it's pretty targeted for the eye, so that really stands out. You know, we didn't do much, we didn't go too fancy with the tweaking on that shot.
And in normal kind of setups, you know, when they're more exteriors and stuff and you've got close-ups, are you
just doing the highlights in the eyes with bounce cards, or do you like to have a China ball?
You know, we did a lot, you know, in environments. There's a lot of stuff with Vika that was in the Sky Tower, where she's doing all the, you know, she's at the controls for the whole thing. I think that's in the trailer. I mean, a lot of the reflections I lit her, I had a screen that was all, you know, we had six projectors blasting the sky reflections at the screen, and that kind of comes across in her eyes.
Right.
And I mean, it's also kind of how I lit her as well, through this giant screen. And it also was kind of like the big key point of how to light the Sky Tower. The Sky Tower is an amazing set, and we lit that with 21 projectors, and that was a 500-foot by 42-foot tall screen.
So obviously the script calls for a lot of synthetic environments and stuff. Were you shooting with blue or green screen, and how did you approach those?
That was the thing I was telling you. Like, a lot of it we tried to do, you know, in camera. Like, the Sky Tower itself is all in camera. We did, that was what I was telling you about. I sent a crew to Hawaii to shoot 15K plates.
Right.
Live action. There was three epics, you know, with lenses to create this kind of 180 view at 15K. And we surrounded the set with 21 projectors, and all my lighting was pretty much done with that, mostly.
Do you think that helps the actors as well, to have something to...
Oh, my God. This was a set... I mean, this is what's very unique to Oblivion. You know, Tom goes like, God, I love being in here. No blue screen. I'm really in my environment. And he goes like, you know, it's you walk on set, and it's... And this, you know, sun's out and the clouds are out and it's all moving and it's all, you know, it's the clouds are moving around the set, and it's, you know, to have 500 feet of screen at 15K resolution is pretty outstanding, you know. I mean, just imagine yourself in that whole thing with, you know, you're in a glass tower up in the sky, and all the glass reflections are real, all the human skin subsurface is all real, it's all... I don't know. That was that is something I think is so unique to this movie, you know. And it was quite a feat. It was a big install. It was a big commitment.
So what was the sort of most complicated setup from your point of view? Was it, once you'd got that set up, of course it sounded like it was great to shoot on. Was that one of the harder setups to start with, or was there a more...
That was one of the hardest setups. Harder setups to start with. It's a hard setup, but, you know, like anything else, like even in Life of Pi, there's big setups. That was the biggest setup of our movie, was the Sky Tower. But once we start shooting, you know, I just have, you know, it's like you're on location, you know, you have skies out there. But the convenient thing is I could put the sun wherever I want to. So I could I could take the whole plates and I could rotate the sun to be coming from the right. And I could either, you know, generate a little bit more sunlight coming from the right or left. And I could say, I mean, it's a strange kind of feeling going like, okay, let's take the time a little bit more high noon. Then you take high noon, all the 21 projectors go to high noon, and they all start playing the plates from high noon. Make it night, moon comes up, you know, we have a destroyed moon because VFX put a destroyed moon in the scene, and then you have... It's pretty amazing. It's really cool.
I mean, that does sound cool, because that's incredible. How long did it take?
The amazing thing is that if I would have done that blue screen, there would be a VFX requirement to make things, all the textures duller, for instance, right?
Yeah.
Not shiny. And all the glass would have to be taken away. So that would be like one requirement. But because if I turned it blue, you know, the set almost disappears. In fact, there's one shot where we did have to turn it blue, and the set just disappeared for this one shot where he's walking along the bridge. There was this huge crane move, and we turned it blue for that one scene, and the set just—it was just tragic, you know. So shooting it blue would have been super tragic. And then plus, what I also have is real atmospherics, like with projection, I ran smoke on the stage. And there's a shot where he goes from inside to outside. You're going to totally believe it's in camera.
So, I mean, obviously, rear projection and back in the day, these were used, but they always had a problem with believability, mainly because of light levels. Is it the fact that these projectors can just put out enough light that you can
factor that we could do with enough light, and there's the fact that these cameras now are so sensitive. I mean, I shot the whole thing at 800 at a 1:42 split, and sometimes wide open. I mean, I need it all. You know what I mean? It's like those situations were not possible before.
How long would it take? I mean, if you're saying that, you know, just changing the time of day, but there's 15 projectors and a bunch of stuff. I mean, was the setup time, by the time you got your camera moved, they'd have fixed it, or were you ever waiting on that?
Oh no, I could just call. We had all the scenes kind of laid out, you know. I mean, I usually it took a little time for me because usually we were shooting something else, and then I kind of went to the projection to see how it's coming along. Is this going to work? You know, we had our doubts. You know, the producers were a little bit not sure about the idea. You know, we always knew in the back, you know, if everything went wrong, I could always just turn the thing blue if I wanted to. You know, I mean, just blue that, you know, just make projectors blue. I mean, that would have been a waste of money, you know. You know, and originally I thought maybe I could do long lenses and mediums, and maybe the wides we'd have to do blue screen, but we did everything.
If you're shooting nearly wide open on the F-65, is it Johannes who's your focus puller? He must have had his work cut out for him.
Oh, yeah. No, he's the same focus puller that did Tron for me. And Tron, because, you know, Tron, by the nature of the suits, had to be shot wide open, just because we needed to get all the light we could from those suits. So he was used to a 1:3. So. And plus, you have the instant feedback of HD that you can kind of really judge and know if you got it sharp or not. You know what I mean? There is no kind of questioning it after the fact. You know, if you have a question, you just hit play back, and you know you got it or not, and you can move on from there, which is kind of a critical thing. And also, I also felt like this shallow depth of field helped the leavability of the projection too. You know what I mean? If the projection might have been a little bit too sharp, it might have been more of a problem. You know, because the clouds aren't miles away; they're maybe, you know, 75 feet away or 100 feet away. You know what I mean? And little dolly moves, and thank God the clouds are moving, because I thought there might be parallax problems, but there wasn't any parallax problems because the clouds are kind of moving, and if you did do a dolly move, you don't get grounded with a hard shape. Yeah, I mean, we might have had more problems if there was like a cityscape outside, but because we're kind of in this cloud environment, it's very forgiving.
Of course, the primary reason you don't want to do that and lock in the imagery is that somebody changes their mind later. And often on set, people don't know what they want, and you end up wanting to change stuff. And if you change stuff and you've projected up the wrong set of clouds, for example, then you're going to have to get out a team of roto artists. So I asked Digital Domain's Eric Barber just how successful was it, and did they end up having to do a ton of roto?
I think for the most part, it worked brilliantly well. You know, I think it was originally Joe's idea. Early on, I'm not even sure if the movie was green. I guess it was a Universal at this point, because I started working on it with Joe when I was still at Disney, right after Tron, and then it kind of got put on hold a teeny bit and got shopped around, and then went picked up back at Universal. I got a test model of the bubble ship from Darren Guilford, who I've also worked a lot with, and I was trying to figure out, not the bubble ship, the Sky Tower. Yeah. I was trying to figure out how would you put, you know, a process screen up to work with all these surfaces, and Darren loves glass and reflective objects and all these things, and I'm going, this is going to be miserable. And then, you know, I met with Joe, and I kind of showed him some of these tests. He's like, well, I want to project it. I want to get as much in camera as possible. I'm like, love that idea. And it was really, and Claudio, you know, loved that idea, and, you know, we did some tests with PRG, and they just had a really fight to get those projectors, because they needed all the light they can get, I'm sure. But in the end, I think, maybe we didn't get the exact stop we wanted. So in the comps, when I had to, I just boost up the exterior. It wasn't terribly difficult, and so it feels right. You know, with the laser projector, maybe some projectors that are coming down the road, that we'd probably get the stop we wanted. But ultimately, I think everyone was very happy with the outcome.
In those occasions where you didn't quite get the stop, was it a matter of increasing what was there, or did you have to sort of add on top of what was there to get the exposure?
I would typically just boost it up so that, you know, if we're inside shooting outside, typically, you know, it's going to be a little more overexposed. But with the projection, even wide open, we weren't always getting that feel. And so I'd done enough photography on set to know what I thought we should do. And so we would just boost it up in the comp, but it wasn't like it needed all the time. And it certainly wasn't difficult to do at all.
Were there any shots that really stuck out for you where this worked very well?
Any of the shots where, you know, especially wide open where we were on, you know, Jack or Vika, the Tom Cruise or Andrea character, and we were, of course, up close, then the backgrounds would naturally be fairly out of focus. The illusion is incredibly real. All the little reflections and refractions in their coffee pot or whatever they had, the glass, the counters, all that color was naturally there. So I think it worked really well. I mean, Joe got a lot of shots as he intended in camera.
Yeah, in fact, one of the points we discussed was how great it made their eyes look, because that reflection in their eyes just helped sell the close-up so well.
Absolutely. You got real color. And because, you know, we had sent a team out to Maui, having been to Hawaii a bunch of times, I had brought it up in our meeting and said, hey, we should send someone to Hawaii because you get a new sky every 5 minutes, and we'd have these amazing clouds. And then someone said, hey, the Maui Observatory would be great, and that's what we did, and those plates were amazing. So getting that natural color into the Sky Tower was fantastic.
So let me understand this correctly. You had a really hard time finding one of your team that was willing to go to Hawaii to hang out with three epics filming something that required no direction.
Well, ironically, it was Bjorn that we ended up sending, because the way the shot breakout came, the Sky Tower shots ended up being on his plate, and he wanted to do it. And we did a test here at DD on our roof with the mount, and we put the three epics on it, and we looked at the footage, and we thought, okay, this is going to work. And then off he went, and he had never been to Maui before, or Hawaii for that matter. So I just gave him a grin. I'm like, you're going to have a good time. You know, hopefully you won't freeze up there, but you'll have a really great time. And he did. So, yeah, it wasn't hard to find volunteers for that. But
there are people down there. Things you need to know.
I don't want to know! You're still an effective team.
We are not an effective team.
They're firing on survivors.
Stand down!
This is insubordinate behavior.
The relationship between the DOP and the visual effects supervisor is absolutely critical, and clearly Claudio speaks very highly of Eric Barber.
Yeah, that's nice of him. I mean, we've done so many jobs together over the last 10 or 11 years. He's my brother from another mother, as I always refer to him. That, you know, we definitely help each other out whenever we're shooting, and certainly enjoy each other's company.
He's great. You know, we're you know, sometimes we look at each other with like raised eyebrows, like, projection, huh? You're going to bake it in and not have control, you know, and Eric's kind of going like, oh, you're going to bake this in, you know, and I said, yeah, but it's a good thing. And he's like, I don't know, Claudio, it's going to be harder to roll it out and then put it in, and then, you know, which is true, it'd be harder to get rid of it if you're not happy with it and then put something over it once it's committed just to a particular sky, or, you know what I mean? So,
yeah, it's a great thing to get it in camera, as long as no one later on decides they want to change it.
You don't want to change it. So that was what, you know, Eric kind of brought up, and I was like, going like, as long as you're happy, I'm totally happy. But as soon as we become unhappy with it, then I'm really super unhappy with it. You know, but Eric and I have always had a good relationship. I mean, the whole thing, you know, between us and VFX companies, you know, we all have to work with, you know, director, you know, myself and Eric, and I've always had, you know, pretty good relationship with VFX houses and how we, and the process of shooting, you know.
How aware were you, or how surprised were you by the sort of situation that happened, what with Rhythm and Hues following on the heels as it did of Digital Domain?
Oh, yeah, no, I mean, it's a little bit a shame that R&H just has having this problem, you know. I'm hoping I'm not the cause of them going bankrupt. I doubt it, but you know, I mean, yeah, it's terribly sad. I mean, it's also sad for, it's not just what they're being affected, it's also like my crew's being affected too, because for me, my next two jobs are not in Los Angeles or in California or in the States. They're in Vancouver, you know, because of the tax break, you know. You know, it's hard to shoot in the States because of the tax break. So people are, you know, outsourcing tremendously, and that's and they're writing such thin margins, you know, to keep competitive, you know. And I told them, you know, I said, you know, guys, you got to get in a situation where you're not, like, when they hire me, they don't farm out for the cheapest DP they could find, you know what I mean? You know, but they do that to VFX, you know, and I think that's kind of maybe, I don't know, doesn't seem right sometimes, you know what I mean?
The people you work for lied to you. They told you to follow orders, and soon you would join the others. It's time you know the truth.
Chuck, how do you know my name?
And I was going to ask you if we could just get into one of the really great sequences in the film where Jack's fighting a clone of himself from a sort of a lighting and a DOP point of view, and also just a blocking and sort of structural point of view. How did you approach that on set?
On set, that we did block that with his stunt man, you know, for the other Jack, and then, I mean, it's actually an amazing scene. That scene, you do feel like they're two different Toms. When Tom is playing the opposite, you know, Jack 52, you do feel like that's a different person in a way. You know, like kind of a younger clone of Jack, and just a different kind of mental state. And he looks different for some reason. I go like, wow, he just looks like a completely different Tom, in a way. That was them basically blocking, you know, and we knew the blocking. We videotaped the scene many times, and Tom playing both sides, and we just knew where we had to cut and cheat, and where we knew whether it was going to be VFX or possibly some head replacements. So we did know going into that, you know, what we had to do.
Well, because, you know, Claudia and I have shot both Button and Tron Legacy together, he knew my, you know, how I had to go about doing head replacement. And I think for this film, you know, it wasn't our initial intention to have to do head replacement because of the time involved in trying to get a perfectly photoreal head. And, you know, Joe had been down that road with me on Legacy. So we wanted to come up with a solution that was clever but not slow him down as far as how he had to shoot it, not involve motion control, especially in the environment we were going to be shooting in, and allow the fight to be as visceral and real as possible. And we were going to shoot it over a few days, and we knew that. And so, you know, my whole thing was, like, I'd seen other kind of fights where we'd seen, you know, people fight each other. I mentioned the movie Moon to Joe, and I said, we just have to be really clever about how we plan this. And I think for the most part, we can get away with a lot, and there'll be some shots where we'll do different things. And so once it was choreographed by the stunt coordinator, you know, he actually did a great job. He went out and shot it with his stunt crew and cut it together, and he showed Joe, and Joe gave notes, and then he made some adjustments. And then we had the bones of essentially that fight. And then so I went in and do it and basically broke it down. Okay, this type of shot, look, we could do this as a split screen, and we'll add camera moves afterward. And this type of shot, you know, if you shoot over the shoulder, this will work for this up to a point. And with this type of shot, that might be head replacement. And this type of shot, maybe we'll do a little face paste. And so we broke it out that way, and then brought in the department heads and Tom and the stunt guys on a couple of weekends and rehearsed it. And so my whole thing, as I kept saying, is, like, the more we rehearse this, the more we plan this out, the smoother it's going to go, especially with how complex this has to be. And I think it worked out pretty well. I was pretty happy with the fact everyone got on board, and Tom was great, and the rehearsals really helped.
Let's swing to some of the more sort of CG kind of stuff. In particular, I wanted to discuss the hydro rigs, if I could.
Well, the challenge with the hydro rigs was scale. And, you know, we've never seen a platform like this over an ocean, and we certainly haven't seen these drones that are flying around. And the idea of these hydro rigs pulling, you know, the materials out of the ocean. The challenge there was how do we make them look real and otherworldly and put them in these amazing Icelandic backdrops that have to then be, you know, post-apocalyptic kind of a New York environment. But it was really scale that was the challenge, because a lot of the tet design world At the small level, at the micro scale with the bubble ship and the drones and even the Sky Tower are super highly designed and really beautiful. The larger pieces, like the Hydra rig and even the Tet, they're more simplistic in their beauties and their shapes and their design. So it was a challenge.
and solving that, was it atmospherics? I mean, what were the sort of tools in your tool chest that made that work?
Well, we try to use the as much of the key pieces in the plate, atmosphere certainly being one of them, water scale, distance. We had these amazing vistas from Iceland. If you see these plates, you go, wow, that almost looks unreal because it's so beautiful and it's very graphic and it's so clear. And then we have Tom perched up on a rock, and it almost feels like it was a blue screen shot. But I mean, these plates were unreal. The F-65 is unreal as far as the clarity and how sharp everything is. So it was tough. We tried to use adding little rainbows and small little effects, and just you name it, we pulled out every trick we could because to try to sell them.
Yeah, I was interested to see what you thought of the F-65. What was the sort of color space / workflow that? How were the files coming in? Initially, it was planned as 4Ks post, wasn't it?
That was the intention, and actually, to a large degree, whenever we had an issue with the plate, if we had to stabilize or push in on one or add a little camera move, we would request the 4K plate. So, to a large degree, we worked with the 4K plates whenever we could. It made our lives a little easier, ultimately. And then, we're delivering 2K, but pushing around the 4K to make that stuff work a little better. I was completely impressed with the F-65. I mean, the image coming out of that thing is gorgeous. You have plenty of stops, in either direction, and in some cases, like in Raven Rock, where it was an incredibly dark environment, you could pull out detail in other cameras. Maybe that detail didn't exist there, but there was still detail, and the noise wasn't too bad. On the rare occasion we got underexposed stuff, we were able to work with it.
And for our sort of drones and CG, inverted pyramids, sky towers, etc. A lot of ray tracing, I imagine. What's the pipeline for rendering out your CG elements?
Well, much like Tron, we decided we would use V-Ray on this show, and it's become the studio standard now. We built a pretty robust tool set with our lighting teams, and they're pretty happy with it. And obviously, with full-on ray tracing, it just means you're going to be waiting for some frames sometimes, but. In this case, you mentioned the long Raven Rock shot with the drone kind of doing its business. Some of those frames could take 60 hours a frame, but in the end, it was certainly worth it.
Was that 60 hours elapsed or 60 sort of machine hours, just out of curiosity?
Well, it would be 60 hours on a single machine that I think is a 16-core machine.
Right. Yeah, that's pretty good.
It's not something I'm normally comfortable with. I generally have a rule of thumb. It's like, look, if we can't turn it around in a day, if you back me into a corner and the shot has to go out the door, I can't rerun a 60-frame shot. And then they remind me that we have these super uber machines that we can throw, tons and tons of buckets at, and they can knock those out a little faster. And again, we've got a lot of robust tools, and the Chaos Group has worked with our guys here, and I mean, they've got a really robust renderer.
I mean, one thinks of this obviously as a live-action film, but about, 15% of this is actually just fully CG? I mean, it doesn't look like a kid's film, but it's absolutely synthetically generated material.
Certainly, there's a large chunk that we were responsible for, and I think there's a good chunk of aerial battle that Pixar was responsible for that fits that category where it's completely generated. Unlike Tron, which is kind of like 15% live action, 85% all generated, this is probably the opposite ratio. But
and I guess that final shot count was helped by the fact that, as we said at the outset, you had a large amount of stuff that maybe was going to be process screen that you actually got most of in camera from the projector rig.
Yeah, the final shot count, I kind of laughed originally when at the target for the film. I just didn't know how we would hit that number, and I'll be honest with you, the final shot count is below that number. So, Joe did get a lot of great stuff in camera, and I think everyone's kind of stuck to the plan, and it all worked out really well. I think there's a lot of planning that went into it to help make it work.
Though I guess shot count is a fairly hopeless measure of complexity, just of editing.
certainly that's the case. When you have that level of, look, we have to add a drone into the shot, and you've done a few of them. It's like, oh, that's fairly simple. Where you have to add something into this live-action plate, an explosion or whatever. But then you get the fully CG shots, and those are monsters. So we have a number of those at the end of the film. They just take more time and development. You know, Joe has a very specific aesthetic he was after, and so that just takes a while to get it just right.
Well, in finishing up, I was really curious to know what Claudio thought of maybe the new F-55, because this was shot on the F-65. He'd shot Tron on the F-35, and as we'd started there, I thought we'd finish by looking forward. And I asked him, basically, was he interested in this sort of new lightweight F-55 camera, and what was his opinion of it? Was it a good camera? Did he like it?
Yeah, I think I'm very interested in you know, for Steadicam or light rigs to shoot with it. I mean, it's interesting that it's a, you know, 1200 ASA camera. I mean, my God, now it's the first at that, you know. I got like, it's interesting opportunities kind of come up with that kind of ASA, you know. A shooting projection of 1280, I mean, I was struggling a little bit on set with, you know, 800, you know.
Yeah, it does seem that there's been more innovation in cameras in the last few years than you know, one could reasonably hope for. It's been moving very quickly between like three or four of the major camera companies.
Right. I did a test recently, I think it's in my next movie, where I shot, you know, IMAX 15 perf, 8 perf, 5 perf, Panavision film 35. I had a rig that had 7 cameras on the nose.
Wow.
And I drove around downtown with, you know, Red Epic, Alexa Studio, and F-65. And I put one F-55 on the top. It wasn't part of the player because I knew the F-65 was still the, you know, the strongest Sony camera, even with the, you know, it's still stronger than the F-55. But it was interesting to see all those different formats and just how, and it was just amazing to see, you know, the digital camera at night really, you know, the city continues being lit. You know, it's like, it's different from movies that, you know, back in the days where you stop lighting, it just gets dark, you know. So, if you can only light 4 blocks, you know, in a city on film in the past, it just goes to black. But what's interesting now is that digital, you can kind of, the block keeps on going in some sort of form, and you could see helicopters and things flying around at night. I don't know, I find that really wonderful. And, you know, and I think Deakins, you know, when he did Skyfall, that whole kind of projection scene is, you know, you just know that's possible because of digital, you know. And I talked to Deakins a little bit about that, and he loves the format.
Yeah.
He loved what he talked about. He responded to something that you responded to, was the eyes, you know. There's a sharpness in the eyes that he loves seeing, you know. And I kind of go like, you know, right, there's something interesting about that, you know, that you get that little ping in the eyes that you connect with the actors in that kind of way.
I think for many people, they would have thought, had you not done Life of Pi in this Academy sweep, he may have done better at the Oscars this year, because he obviously does great work.
He does great. Well, he did win my guild.
That's true. I was going to ask you about one other thing with lenses, which is anamorphics. You did some amazing, huge array of anamorphic tests, which you generously published on your own website. And I was wondering, and that was a flare test, but there has been a lot of renewed interest in anamorphics. Many of the camera companies are providing 4:3 options for anamorphics. Do you enjoy shooting that way? Do you think that they're getting...
I do, and I did test it for Oblivion, you know, but the problem was for me on Oblivion, now my stops are 2 to 2.3 at best, you know, and with more focus issues than ever I would have had, so I probably have been needing to shoot at 2.8. So instead of 21 projectors, if I calculate that up, now I'm into 84 projectors to get the stop I needed on anamorphic. Right?
Wow.
So instead of costing, you know, and then, okay, where do they go? I don't know where they go. Just, you know, as far as a stop increase. So this is why projection wasn't done in the past, you know, because for me to say I want 84 scene projectors, oh my God, they'd freaking go through ballistic, you know.
Yeah, and the chances of something failing or one of them being out of sync for some reason is just goes through the roof, doesn't
it? Oh, yeah. I mean, we had our own problems with 21. I mean, but you know what I'm saying? So that's why people haven't done that, and that's why this opportunity now works versus, you know, it didn't work then.
Yeah. It does seem, though, that we've had, as we had a luxury of cameras, also had a luxury of new lenses, and that return to anamorphic seems to create a lot of interest. A lot of people seem to be looking at that. What are you moving forward to? You said you're shooting up in Vancouver. We'd like to know what those projects are.
Oh, I'm doing Tomorrowland with Brad Bird.
Right.
And Brad Bird's a, you know, a lover of film, and I'm I'm trying to, you know, in our movie, there's a lot of worlds that would benefit from shooting digital, because I what I love is kind of interactive light from projection, and a lot of what I do is based loving this low light ability to do these tricks. As soon as they start getting where I start needing more light, you know, as an IMAX or anything else, my tools that were so elegant become very big and cumbersome. You know what I mean? So because I just need 4 times the amount of light, you know.
Right.
So there's so sometimes I get a little nervous. I start to go, wow, I have all these tricks that I kind of love now, you know, where I could just take a very light and bounce it on a wall and pan it around in some sort of program where that works for the going into the ship of Oblivion, you know, into the main,
yeah,
the ship up in the sky. But that doesn't work for film. Oh, God. I still love film, but film, it's problematic. You know, we had bad batches, and, you know, and I was like, really?
Well, and the split is hardly at the same level that you're going to get off a F-65 in terms of what you're being able to look at on the monitor.
Yeah, no. So it's nice to have that kind of exposure reference, which I like. You know, Brad sometimes feels like some of the shots look digital, and I go like, yeah. I'm trying to see about, you know, maybe, you know, doing a printout on the F-65 and then re-scanning it back out again for like a film look, or run a digital film look, or play with some sort of muxing, you know what I mean?
Yes, well, Curfew, which won the best live action short film this year, did exactly uh-huh. that. They shot on red, ran through out to a film recorder onto NEG, and then re-scanned the NEG to get a film look, and they were very happy with that. Again, I think they were shooting very 235 in that look. It is an interesting opportunity, especially. Just to be clarified, that have you committed to shooting film or digital on that Brad Bird project?
Tomorrowland. It right now, we on the table is four options.
All right.
For one world is definitely probably F-65, probably for this one world. But the other worlds are definitely IMAX and, you know, what else did he have on the table? We had Panavision 65mm, 5-perf, and then we have regular 35mm. So far there's four systems. For me, that's a little clumsy. I can go 35 and F-65. And maybe an occasional IMAX. I just don't know if I need all of them. You know, it's just a lot of work. I mean, I kind of almost compared the F-65 in looking and sharpness to almost 8-perf, 65mm. You know, it was almost very comparable to the iWorks in sharpness.
Right, and of course that IMAX gets such a shallow depth of field as well.
And IMAX is really shallow depth of field, but you know, you have to shoot IMAX at a 2.8 or 4 anyway, so you're not shooting at a 1.3, you know,
yep.
I mean, because there's no 1.3 lenses. I think Nolan had some two-stop lenses built, I think, right, for Wally Pfister. I think Wally had some, Panavision made some T2 lenses, but I wasn't privy to when I shot my test. So, you know, I just go with what I have basis, what's on the table for me, you know.
Yeah. Well, look, it's been terrific talking to you, and thank you so much for taking time out. I really enjoyed it. Thank you so much.
All right, thanks. All right, bye.
Well, thanks, Mike. That was really great, and thanks to Claudia and Eric, obviously.
Yeah, I want to give a shout-out to Julie at DD, who helped organize stuff.
Julie Miller.
We don't normally mention somebody that's in the marketing or publicity department, but she is one of the good ones, and we really appreciate her help.
Yeah, and we've known Julie for a long time before she was a DD, and now that she's at DD, obviously. So obviously FX PhD and FX Guide are our two websites. And FX Guide is partially funded by you, by the FX Insider program.
Yeah, I'm actually completely humbled by the fact that we've had such amazing industry support. People said that we'd have to flood the site with a lot of banner ads to be able to support and do the kind of work we did. And certainly I had somebody once, you know, say to me that we'd never be able to build because there wouldn't be no support from the industry. And it's absolutely not the case. As you'll see, we do have some banner advertising, or rather we like to call it sponsorship, but we don't plaster it with ads for, you know, every kind of cable tie and you know, thing, because we have the Insider program where people become members of the program. And as our way of kind of saying thanks to that, in a bit like the way that they do with the public radio pledge, we actually do extra interviews, extra stuff, and post that so that as an Insider member you get an extra level of kind of content from us. So we do genuinely and sincerely appreciate the stuff that you guys do.
Right, and you can find out all the details of that over at fxguide.com. Just click the FX Insider tab. Well, thanks, Mike.
Hey, thanks to you, Jeff. Then.
All right, well, you've been listening to the FX Podcast. We also produce two other audio podcasts. The VFX Show reviews visual effects in current releases, as well as classic films. The RC Podcast covers the ever-changing landscape of digital cinematography. We also produced a high-definition video podcast, FX Guide TV. You can find all of these, along with in-depth articles, news, and more, at fxguide.com. And as we mentioned, check out our sister site, fxphd.com, that offers extensive online visual effects training. Well, that'll do it for this episode. For my partners, Mike Seymour and John Montgomery, I'm Jeff Huser. We'll see you on the next FX Podcast.
Man, you just do that so well. Thanks, Jeff.
Thanks for listening to this week's FX Podcast. Please let us know if you have any suggestions for stories or future podcasts. You can reach us by using the Contact Us links at the top of the homepage. This podcast is copyright 2007 FX Guide LLC. Broadcast or redistribution is prohibited without the expressed written consent of FX Guide LLC.